She's a recovering alcoholic. He's a meth addict in recovery. She's in recovery from cancer. He's recovering from pneumonia. She's recovering from the stomach flu. What an amazing recovery! Peisner fumbled, but Adams recovered the ball. Johnson bobbled on the balance beam, but fought hard and recovered the dismount. Oh, the holidays were exhausting, but I'm finally recovering. Last night we ordered pizza and sat on the couch and watched a movie. Finally. And finally, the best way to recover from a broken heart involves eating a pint of Ben & Jerry's in the bathtub. We have many different ways of talking about recovery. We can recover from addiction, from illness, from heartbreak, from stress, or just from a loss of balance. But no matter what we're recovering from, recovery, in its broadest sense, is about coming back in to balance. This is not a New Year's sermon, per se, but I think it's a very good time of year to discuss the concept of returning to balance. The holidays, for many of us, are a time of heightened expectations and busier schedules. For example, between the two of them, my daughters, during the month of December, had 4 girl choir concerts, 3 pageant rehearsals, 2 handbell concerts, and a Christmas pageant in December. Add into that 3 different family celebrations, shopping, cooking, making fudge, making Chex Mix, baking cookies, and putting up a Christmas tree, and I can assure you that December did not feel very balanced. Much of it is fun, but it's also expensive and time-consuming, and there's never enough time to do what you want to do, which often involves just sitting down and looking at the lights on the Christmas tree. I think it's one of the reasons I'm so committed to lighting Hanukkah candles. Even though it's one more thing to remember, there's something very grounding about that action of lighting candles and saying blessings in the evenings. For a few minutes, the rushing stops, and we are pulled back into balance. I'm not really one for New Year's resolutions, but this year, I'm realizing that for me, at this particular point in time, coming back into balance is going to mean less dairy and less sugar. With Christmas cookies and fudge and candy everywhere I've turned for the last several weeks, I feel like I've gotten out of balance. And it's nothing, it really has nothing to do with dieting. It's just sort of about achieving balance again. Balance can mean so many different things. It can mean a healthy body as opposed to one suffering from illness or disease. For some things, a moderate amount of something is fine. For me, cookies are like this. I enjoy cookies. And while I admit that I have occasionally been known to nibble 4 Joe's O's instead of the recommended serving size of 2, I still think that's within the realm of acceptable behavior. I've never been one of those people who sits down with a package of cookies and eats the entire thing in one sitting, nor am I gluten intolerant. For me, cookies are something that I can eat in moderation and still remain in balance. But what about people who can't achieve balance with a particular substance? Sometimes it's an allergy or a sensitivity. All the moderation in the world doesn't make it okay for me to eat fruit, for example. Folks with celiac disease can't have the smallest trace of gluten without getting sick. And sometimes it's an addiction to particular behavior or substance. One of the most common uses for the word recovery is to be in a 12-step program recovering from addiction to alcohol or drugs, or from gambling, sexual addiction, overeating, or other compulsive behaviors. 12-step programs are so named because of their reliance on 12 steps to recovery. The first 12-step program was Alcoholics Anonymous. But over time, these same principles have been used to help people break free from a variety of addictive behaviors. This version is used with all types of recovery, so specific references to, for example, alcohol have been removed. So the 12 steps are, step one, we admitted that we were powerless over the addiction, that our lives had become unmanageable. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. Humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer or meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. And finally, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other addicts and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. There's an awful lot of God language in these steps, but the tagline to number three is very important: as we understood God. You don't have to have a traditional Judeo-Christian understanding of God to follow these steps. Reverend David Maynard says that the most important idea is that you can't do this alone. There has to be something greater than yourself. As far as I'm concerned, and as far as AA is concerned, that doesn't need to be an omnipotent personal God. It can be the creative force in the universe. It can be the power of gathered humanity. The fourth chapter of the big book, the original book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is entitled We Agnostics. Reflecting its time, the 1930s, it uses the word men when they mean people, and it refers to God as him. But in other ways, I think it speaks to some of the same issues some of us have today. Speaking to the 50% of potential members who have struggled with the idea of God, the author invites them to broaden their perspective and ideas about what God or a higher power might be. And in particular, to stop letting the 1930s version of conservative fundamentalism define how we view spirituality itself. This is a quote. We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices when we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness which we should have sought in ourselves. Instead, we looked at the human defects of these people and sometimes used their shortcomings as a basis of wholesale condemnation. We talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. We missed the reality and the beauty of the forest because we were diverted by the ugliness of some of its trees. At its core, 12-step programs believe that people who are true alcoholics or addicts can't bring themselves into balance around a particular substance or behavior. Therefore, for alcoholics or drug addicts, moderation isn't possible. Only abstinence works if you're truly an addict. For those addictions to activities that, when done in moderation or necessary, are important, recovery can be even harder. Overeaters Anonymous members create a daily food plan and only consume those foods in that amount. Trigger foods are banned. Sexual addiction is managed with a ban on pornography, and no sex with self or others except your spouse. Other recovery programs exist that do not use the concept of a personal God. One of the most common is the SMART Recovery Program, which stands for Self-Management and Recovery Training. This helps individuals gain independence from addiction based on scientific knowledge and evolve as scientific knowledge evolves. And they have a 4-point program that offers tools and techniques for building and maintaining motivation, coping with urges, managing thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and, ta-da, living a balanced life. But interestingly, on their website is a survey of users, and 85% of the users said they also participate in 12-step programs. What about those of us who abuse substances but aren't addicts? According to the tenets of AA and other groups, people who abuse substances but aren't actually addicts may be able to bring themselves into balance around their use of such substances or behaviors. They suggest that you try reducing your use of the substance, giving yourself firm limits and days where you don't use this at all. If that works, great. Maybe you're not addicted, and that's a wonderful thing. If it doesn't work, according to AA, a spiritual solution and abstinence are necessary. But substances aren't the only thing that we can become addicted to. Anything that gives us that sort of amazing high that takes us out of our humdrum existence even for a little while. Elizabeth Gilbert, the author of Eat, Pray, Love, says that for her it was love, or more accurately, infatuation. She writes, "I was suffering the easily foreseeable consequences. Addiction is the hallmark of every infatuation-based love story. It all begins when the object of your adoration bestows upon you a heady, hallucinogenic dose of something you never dared to admit you wanted. An emotional speedball, perhaps, of thunderous love and rolling excitement. Soon you start craving that intense attention with a hungry obsession of any junkie. When the drug is withheld, you promptly turn sick, crazy, and depleted, not to mention resentful of the dealer who encouraged this addiction in the first place, but now refuses to pony up the good stuff anymore, despite the fact that you know he has it hidden somewhere, goddammit, because he used to give it to you for free. Next stage finds you skinny and shaking in a corner, certain that only that you would sell your soul or rob your neighbors just to have that thing even one more time. Meanwhile, the object of your adoration has now become repulsed by you. He looks at you like you're someone he's never met before, much less someone he once loved with high passion. The irony is, you can hardly blame him. I mean, check yourself out. You're a pathetic mess, unrecognizable to even your own eyes. So that's it. You have now reached infatuation's final destination, the complete and merciless devaluation of self. AA and 12-step programs speak of a selfish need to have the substance despite what it does to your relationships or your job or your life. Gilbert says that the final stage of infatuation is the complete devaluation of self. Both are indicative of a life seriously out of balance. So how do we get back into balance? That wise and oft-quoted soul, Euripides, writing 2,500 years ago, said, "The best and safest thing is to keep a balance in your life. Acknowledge the great powers around us and in us. If you can do that and live that way, you really are a wise man or woman." I think this might be a key here. Acknowledging the great powers around us and in us, and realizing that for us to be in balance, sometimes we look to those forces outside of us, and sometimes to those forces within us. The key is knowing when to look where, and when possible, integrating those forces. My own definition of Unitarian Universalism is that we gather together believing in something larger than ourselves. What that something is varies widely. For some people, it's God. For some of us, it's the power of science, the awesomeness of the universe, or the power of gathered humanity. But we believe that we are better off together than we are alone. And we believe that what we do here on Earth matters because we don't know what happens afterwards. We are very this-worldly, and we work to make this world a better place, more fair and just and compassionate. Nowhere does this definition contain a requirement about believing in a higher power. But it does say that we look to something outside of our immediate selves, even when that's each other. Whatever that something or power outside yourself is, you are responsible to it. No one else in this world can make it solely on their own. Someone else birthed you and raised you. Someone else planted the food you eat. Someone else made the car you drive, or the light rail you take, or drives your bus route. You may well work hard for the money that you use to buy all of these things, but we are all interdependent beyond what we really can even imagine. We are a communal society, with each of us focused on one particular job or project in the world. Even if you have a great garden and raise your own chickens, clean water still comes to your house, and your sewage gets carried away. Someone raises the cotton to weave into the cloth that makes the clothes you wear. We are all a part of this great circle. No matter what we think of the current system of mass agriculture in the United States today, or the use of fossil fuels, we do not and we cannot operate in a vacuum. We each have a role to play, depending on our desires and talents. Some of us teach children. Some of us raise children. Some of us help birth them. Others of us build houses or do accounting or work for the city. Others of us have retired from our jobs and now work at the library or help others grow gardens or fix things or nurture grandchildren or put a great deal of energy into maintaining our church community. I believe that just acknowledging this is in some ways a sense of acknowledging the powers both within and around us. We make a difference in our world by doing what we do. Sometimes that difference feels huge, and sometimes it may feel very small indeed, but we do make a difference. And we are incredibly interdependent. We do none of this in isolation. And we do none of this alone. Sometimes we have to do certain things alone. Sometimes life requires that we pull ourselves up by our proverbial bootstraps. Sometimes letting us go of things that are bad for us, an ill-advised love affair, too much sugar or drink, or rushing around or spending money, or any of a thousand other traps we fall into. Sometimes we have to be the ones to stop ourselves. Ultimately, we are responsible for who we love, what we put in our bodies, and how we conduct ourselves in the world. And sometimes we are incapable of doing these things alone. Sometimes addiction or illness requires that we get help. Then we go to AA, or we see the doctor, or we take antidepressants. We still have responsibility, but we may not be able to do it ourselves, and that is okay. Sometimes, the hardest thing to do is to figure out what we can do alone and what we need help with. Sometimes our struggles are invisible to those around us, and we have to figure out what to share and what to keep hidden. Jenny Larson, who blogs as The Bloggess, wrote recently, "If you follow me on Twitter, you already know that I've been battling off one of the most severe bouts of depression I've ever had. Yesterday, it started to pass, and for the first time in weeks, I cried with relief instead of hopelessness. Depression can be crippling and deadly. I'm lucky that it's a rare thing for me and that I have a support system to lean on. I'm lucky that I've learned that depression lies to you and that you should never listen to it, in spite of how persuasive it is at the time. When cancer sufferers fight, recover, and go into remission, we laud their bravery. We call them survivors because they are. When depression sufferers fight, recover, and go into remission, we seldom even know, simply because so many suffer in the dark, ashamed to admit something that they see as a personal weakness, afraid that people will worry, and more afraid that they won't. We find ourselves unable to do anything except cling to the couch and force ourselves to breathe. When you come out of the grips of a depression, there is an incredible relief, but not one you feel allowed to celebrate. Instead, the feeling of victory is replaced with anxiety that it will happen again, and with shame and vulnerability when you see how your illness affected your family, your work, everything left untouched while you struggled to survive. We come back to life thinner, paler, weaker, but as survivors. Survivors who don't get pats on the back from coworkers who congratulate them on making it. Survivors who wake to more work than before because their friends and family are exhausted from helping them fight a battle they may not even understand. Regardless, she writes, today I feel proud. I survived. And I celebrate every one of you reading or listening to this. I celebrate the fact that you've fought your battle and continue to win. I celebrate the fact that you may not understand the battle, but you pick up the baton dropped by someone you love until they can carry it again. I celebrate the fact that each time we go through this, we get a little bit stronger. We learn new tricks on the battlefield. We learn them in terrible ways, but we use them. We don't struggle in vain. We win. We are alive. My friends, whatever burdens we are dealing with right now, whatever we need to recover from, whatever balance we are struggling to achieve, let us remember that we don't struggle alone, and we don't need to do it all ourselves. We have community. We have grace and whatever outside ourselves that we cling to that holds us up. We have modern medicine and inner strength and friends and laughter and really good ice cream. We have exercise and beautiful places to walk and the beauty of this city and the natural world. We can balance what we do alone and what we can do together.